What's it like to be alone? I mean, really alone, not just lonely. You could be sitting right here in the middle of this congregation and still be lonely based on your feelings and your circumstances and how things have worked out in your life. What's it like to be completely uninterrupted in what you feel and what you think? Now, if you live alone, then you might know more what that feels like than many of the rest of us. But then again, there's still TV and the coming and going of society all around us. I feel fairly confident that if I asked that there would be some right here, maybe quite a number of us right here in this room today, who have never been alone for, say, a day in their entire lives. And by that I mean 24 hours. Think about that. How many of you have never, don't raise your hands because it's not important in that sense, but how many of you have never been alone for 24 hours in your entire life? I mean, not a person, not a single human being around, totally by yourself. I know Megan and Derek have never been alone, and I doubt Michelle has ever, for 24 hours, never been around even so much as another human being. Everything we do in a social context. We do it with people around, or friends around, or family around, or at least we go where there people are. And it fills our time and our day, and it fills the way we process things. Our activities, our responsibilities totally consume us oftentimes. We get up in the morning to an alarm clock. We go to bed oftentimes exhausted after a busy day, and you look back and most of the time everything through that day was filled. Now every single person, maybe that won't be the same, but I think for many of us it will. Our lives are so full that they're probably jammed to the limits of what we are able to do and accomplish. I was talking to Byron last night. Anybody who talks to me on Friday night ends up in the sermon. So I just warn you, if you call me on Friday, you're in the sermon. But talking to Byron last night, and he was just mentioning the internet and how sometimes he has lunch and he'll go and he'll just look around to see what all is there. And he said, you know, there's so much out there. There's information there that, as we were discussing, that you could never understand and even assume to assimilate or find all that information that is out there. There's a website, it's called, and I don't remember exactly the name, but it's something like Church of God Assorted Flavors or Assorted Flavors of the Church of God. And a number of you, how many have accessed that website? Some of you, look at this. Okay, there's a few. I've been in there and out of there. And it's got all these flavors of the Church of God. There's chocolate and vanilla and pepperoni. No, there's no pepperoni. Well, you see, there's a pepperoni. And strike that from the table. But anyway, there's all these flavors of the Church of God. There's a list of all these different groups and where they have gone and what they're doing and what they believe or information about them. And you can go from that site to maybe 100 other sites. I don't know how many. A lot of different sites. But there's all of these things out there available for us to do. We live in a society where you can find anything that you ever wanted to find, to know, or to do. It is out there. It's available. And there's access now where you can go specialize in it if you choose. You can fill every single waking moment of your life with something. In fact, good Americans will fill those things with two or three things at once. We've mastered the ability to begin to do more than one thing at a time. People use the phone now while they drive. I've actually seen ladies in supermarkets walking down the aisle with a shopping cart with a cell phone on their ear, making a phone call while they shop in the store. I read an article that says the accident rate for those people who use the cellular phones while they drive is up like 60% over not having one, so the chances are high that we don't do two things at once perfectly. We have a portable phone in our home, and Michelle and I take turns getting on each other about what the other one is doing while we're on that phone. Now, I started by picking on her because she would have the cell phone, not cell phone, it's just a portable phone in the kitchen. And I'd hear this clatter, clatter, clank, and I'd say, honey, would you stop and just do the phone call and quit cooking or doing something as you go? And so then she'd wait until she'd hear the modem beep off on my end when I was sitting on the phone. And what it was is I'm sitting there trying to sign on and read some messages while I'm talking, and then she pays me back. But You know, we have now the capacity in society to begin to do not only something all day long, but more than something, but two and maybe three things at once at a time. And we fill our lives up with that. You go to a fast food restaurant and you order your hamburger or your drink or whatever it is that you're buying, and the person who's taking your order at the same time is handing someone else's order out the window to them. Industry has even been designed to get us to maximize a person's time, to get them to accomplish as much as they can. Sometimes even they're doing more than one job at once. Seems more and more that there is more to do and maybe less and less time, it feels like, in order to do it, to accomplish it. Daniel 12 and verse number 4 portrays a time in the context of the end time, talking about the return of Jesus Christ, talking about those who are turned into spirit beings and have the brightness of God shine on them. And in Daniel 12:4, it says, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. It says, many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall increase. And it portrays a time when people become very active and very busy and very energetic, and knowledge just explodes and increases as a result. The internet, to me, is almost threatening. All of a sudden, I now have to have answers for things that I never even knew there were questions for, and somebody else has just spent the last 3 months becoming an expert. And that just seems to be the way the process is taking place. The Hebrew here, where it says run to and fro, refers to kind of an intensely repetitive action. It's used in the sense of rowing a boat. If you've ever rowed a boat, many of you have, you know, you just row and you row, or paddle a canoe and you paddle and you paddle and you paddle, and it just goes on and on and on, and you just keep repeating the same motion over and over again. It's like swimming. It's used in reference to like swimming with the arms, the stroke that never quits as you swim across this open space. It's used in the sense if you were to search for someone in a crowd and you couldn't find them and you just kept continually scanning and scanning the audience to look for that person that you were searching for. So the context here is that there is an incredible increase in knowledge as a result of this intense effort to understand and to learn and to acquire information and to share it. And so if that doesn't describe the circumstance that you and I find ourselves in, then I just don't know what does. I think it's incredibly prophetic in terms of what we find ourselves in today. In the churches of God now, there is what I would describe as a Gnostic movement. If you remember Mr. Orchard's tapes on Gnosticism and what he was portraying there, and I don't know if there have been Bible studies given here on that subject as well, but there is in the churches of God now what I would call a Gnostic movement, a kind of prideful pursuit of knowledge. Nothing wrong with the pursuit of knowledge. I study every chance I get, and I try to learn and understand so that I have concepts and things with which I can teach and matters that I can discuss. But there's a prideful pursuit of knowledge that appears to me to have entered the churches at large. There has been for some long time kind of the sacred names gospel among some. There's the gospel of Noah's Ark. There's a website that I was referred to and I accessed and had some interesting information on there, but I know in one of the shoots of the Church of God that began to pursue information on Noah's Ark and other things like that, and where the Ark was and what happened to it, and the Ark of the Covenant, and on, and where they, and this became a major focus of that church's teaching and instruction. And it was, look, we have something that you don't have, and we have special knowledge, and you don't have that. And this happens on a scale now that I don't believe used to exist. There's even the gospel of the nature of God that has continued on into the churches of God as discussion continues as to how God really does exist, and individuals who claim to really have the true knowledge and the basic knowledge that God gave them personally, and they're going to share it, of course, doesn't agree with what everyone else has also been given by God by their opinion, but this process, it's a Gnosticism, a knowledge, a secret knowledge, something I have, and if you'll listen to me, I'll share it with you, but I'm right, and God will let you know too. There's a certain vanity that goes with some of that. because the gospel of the calendar that's becoming a major issue. Is the calendar an issue? Well, yes, it is. Is the differences in the calendar such an issue that it determines ultimately whether one church is right and another is wrong? I'm not convinced indeed that it is. Calendar is important, but I don't know that the calendar is necessarily a measure of spirituality. I do not know Hebrew. I do not know Greek. I know just a little English. And somehow or other, God willing, He has still chosen to allow me to be used in His service. Now, isn't that incredible? I wish I knew Greek and Hebrew. It would serve me better. But I don't. But that doesn't disqualify me from serving God and from teaching His people. We want to be careful about all of these things that begin to fill our mind and our time and our energies, because sometimes we can be in such hot pursuit of knowledge and in such a prideful pursuit of knowledge that maybe we sidetrack the issues that are fundamentally at stake. One of the papers that I receive at home, I subscribe to something from everyone, it seems. And at the end of an article on the Passover, and the Passover, again, in some areas, is becoming a major issue of discussion as well. And so I said, okay, fine, now I'll go out and I'll start digging through people's papers on the Passover and try to see what all the issues are and how that compares to the position we have taken as a church. But at the end of this article, it just struck me, because I know the individuals here that wrote it, and there are people that I've had association with in the past in a personal way. It says, we'd like to thank all the people who made phone calls or sent Passover papers to us. Many were used in preparation of this article. We would also like to thank the Eternal for giving some of the key points of understanding that we have not seen in any previous writings to us. And I read that, and again, I knew these people, and I thought, now come on. Thank you for contributing your thoughts, what value they were to us. And maybe I've misinterpreted this, but thank you, God, for giving us personally the key points so that we could actually teach everyone else the truth. And it just struck me as a little presumptuous, as a little bit, you know, let's not break our arms patting ourselves on the back. And I think we want to be very, very careful that we can become so filled with the pursuit of knowledge and the pursuit of we are special and the pursuit of what I am and what I can do, that maybe we miss the fundamental points of Christian conduct in the process. You know, Gnosticism, what it really is I know something that you don't know, and you have to have what I have to be as spiritual as I am. That's what Gnosticism really is. In this culture, both in the churches of God, assorted flavors, and in the society that was portrayed by Daniel, where we have information coming out our ears, do we really stop and take the time to think about our lives? Rod was mentioning the God looks on the heart. I read an article recently that said, you know, the heart isn't really shaped like a heart. What's shaped like the heart's the prostate. So, well, I just thought I'd add that to a sermonette. He was talking about the heart. You know, God looks on the heart and He's looking at what we're made out of. And He's not maybe necessarily measuring what is our level of Gnosticism or specialty knowledge or how much do we know about Noah's Ark and the secrets that are therein and how that pertains to salvation. But do we really stop and look at our own hearts? Do we examine our hopes and our plans and our dreams? Do we stop and examine our relationship with God and our relationships with man as well? You know, Rod mentioned 1 Corinthians 11. You know, God actually commands us. He says, don't be negligent to examine yourself before the Passover, because I want you to stop and really take a hard look at yourself. Now, that doesn't mean it's the only time of the year we would ever do that. But it does mean don't let that process come, don't let that symbolism come when you signify to God that we are indeed married in relationship, or at least espoused in relationship, and we signify that conversion, the giving of the Holy Spirit that He has permitted us to have, without really looking at our attitude and approach, with our plans and hopes and dreams, with our attitude and our value system. He He says, I want you to really stop and examine. I want you to think about those things. There's an interesting circumstance that shows up again and again in the Bible. And when I first began to study this out, it was kind of amazing to me, but it happened over and over again. Time and time again, when God was taking someone to give them an important responsibility, He prepared them for that responsibility by giving them time to be alone. Now, you know and I know that when you get up in the morning and you beat the alarm and then you race to get to work and then through the day all the phone rings and the appointments come and the obligations kind of assert themselves and then you get home, of course, there's something to fix or to repair and the family's got needs and on you go. You fill the time to where you don't even stop sometimes to understand and think and process what's really going on. And you can go through your whole life doing that. Time and time again, when God called someone to His service for a special responsibility, He started out by giving them time to be alone. What happens when you're alone? What happens when you're alone for 24 hours and there's no one to talk to and no one to look at and no one to relate to? What happens to your mind? Luke 1, verse number 76, is a prophecy here about John the Baptist. And look how John the Baptist was raised in order to be the one who announced the coming ministry of Jesus Christ. It says, you, child, will be called the prophet of the highest, for you will go before the face of the Lord to prepare His ways, to give knowledge of salvation to His people by the remission of their sins, through the tender mercy of our God, with which the dayspring from on high has visited us, to give light to those who sit in darkness and the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. Big responsibility, quite a job description. Verse 8, he says, so the child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the deserts until the day of his manifestation to Israel. Did God send him to Jerusalem, you, to get ready to serve Him? Well, in this case, no. Because then Jerusalem, you, wasn't indeed what God had in mind. God had him out, it says here, in the deserts, in the wilderness. John the Baptist grew up where he had a lot of time to be alone and to think and to process what was important in this life, what God was preparing him to do, and to get ready to fulfill his role. Now, if that would have happened just one time, I'd say, well, fine, that's just the way it was with John. But there's a lot of cases like that in the Bible. Look at Matthew 3. Starting in verse 13, after John came Jesus, and notice what Jesus did at the beginning of His ministry. Again, a moment in time that took special focus, ready to start out preaching the kingdom, and notice the last thing He did in the course of that. It says, then Jesus came from Galilee to John at the Jordan to be baptized by Him. John tried to prevent Him, saying, I need to be baptized to you. Are you coming to me? Jesus said to him, permit it to be so now, for thus is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness. So you know the story. John baptized Jesus, made very, very evident as to what God's will was. Suddenly a voice came from heaven, verse 17, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And then immediately after that, Christ now fulfills this part of His responsibility. And it goes on, says, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when He had fasted 40 days and 40 nights afterwards, He was hungry. Now, the temptation did not come until the 40 days and 40 nights were finished. So what did He do? He went out into the wilderness to be alone with God, to get your mind off of, well, let's see, what am I going to build today? What am I going to produce today? What am I going to accomplish today? To get his mind onto relationship with God and focus, and then after that came the test. But in the preparation was the 40 days and the 40 nights, effectively here, away from society and everyone else. Now that's quite a luxury at sometimes to take place, but at the same time, as I said, as I began to study this out, I realized it happened over and over again. Look at Galatians 1. Galatians 1 is the calling of Paul. Paul did go to school at Jerusalem U, and he was in that system. And he said, God effectively said, well, still, that's not really what it will take to finish the product so that you can serve me. So Galatians 1, verse 11, this is describing Paul's call to his apostleship. He says, I made known to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man, for I didn't receive it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ. For you have heard of my former conduct in Jerusalem, how I persecuted the church of God beyond measure, and I tried to destroy it. And I advanced in Judaism beyond many of my contemporaries in my own nation, being more exceedingly zealous for the traditions of the elders. The training that he got was still valuable. The attitude and approach wasn't that great, obviously, but the training was still for good use. But that wasn't all of what God intended. When it pleased God who separated me from my mother's womb and called me through his grace to reveal his son in me, that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately confer with flesh and blood. He says, nor did I go to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went to Arabia and returned then again to Damascus. Paul goes on and says, you know, when God took me by the hair and shook me and then said, this is what I want you to do, he says, I didn't go up to the apostles and the church at that moment, even in Jerusalem. God took him by himself because Christ worked with him directly. And it says, took him out to Arabia, took him away, took him out of his society, away from his friends, away from his business contacts and associations, away from his responsibilities, and removed him separately and worked with him alone, is what the indication is. Because these were significant responsibilities and significant individuals that were being prepared. And then he says, after 3 years, then he went back to Jerusalem. And then God said, now you're ready. God doesn't have anything against being in society in that sense, in a right way. God doesn't have anything against being with people. He made people. He created us social. But as you go through this, it would appear that God wanted some time alone with these individuals prior to their call to service in these very special ways. Acts chapter 7. Really, it almost seems like God did this almost as a rule and rather than the exception. Acts chapter 7, verse 22. Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in words and deeds. Some of the histories relate that Moses was actually a general in the Egyptian army. Of course, he was raised in the palace, and so he had incredible education and training. He had incredible opportunities for leadership in the Egyptian system, and he apparently seemed to take advantage of that and prospered within it. When he was 40 years old, it came to his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended and avenged him who was oppressed and struck down the Egyptian. He supposed that his brethren would have understood that God would deliver them by his hand, and they didn't understand. So Moses said, well, look, you know, I'm a leader, I've been a general, I'm one of the trained in the palace individuals, and he says, with all of this training and experience I've got, I will help you. God is going to use me, he somehow showed me this, and I'm ready to lead you out of Egypt. And so he made this very bold move, and it was rejected. He supposed that his brethren would have understood that they would be delivered by his hand. The next day he appeared to two of them as they were fighting, tried to reconcile them. And one of them said, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? Are you going to kill me like you did the Egyptian yesterday? Then at this saying, Moses fled, became a sojourner in the land of Midian, where he had two sons. In the midst of the culture and the palace, in the midst of his great education and opportunity to serve, in the midst of his, if it was accurate, his generalship of the armies, Moses thought he was a leader and was ready to lead Israel, and Israel wasn't ready to be led. When 40 years had passed, doing what? Sitting on a rock, watching the sheep eat the grass, talking to the sheep. How's it going? Not bad. I mean, chatting up, what are you going to say? The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire in the bush in the wilderness of Mount Sinai. When Moses heard it, he marveled at the sight and drew near to him. And then you go again through the story. Now Moses has had 40 years to sit on a rock, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with leading Israel. He's thought about it. He's thought about his life. He's thought about what's important. He's thought about what he needs to do. And he wasn't so impressed with his abilities and his strengths. He's probably sat out there at night looking at the stars and pondering the creation and realizing how majestic God is and how great his power is. And all of a sudden we have a totally different Moses. Moses didn't learn meekness and humility in the Egyptian palace. He appears to have learned it out there tending the sheep. So before Moses was ready to serve God, God took him out and gave him 40 years of solidarity training, or solitary confinement with the sheep. And then in Moses' eyes, he wasn't ready anymore, and in God's eyes, he was. But he took him out there for a long time to be alone. You know that process of examination, 1 Corinthians 11, that we go through prior to the Passover, and at other times has a name? It has a specific name. It's what Moses and Paul and Christ and John the Baptist were naturally doing in the environments that they were in. It's called meditation. It's called meditation, and the Bible refers to it and says effectively that it is fundamental to our success in these Christian lives. Meditation is a tool we use to clarify and strengthen our focus in this life. We sort out our path, and we begin to ponder our ways, and we begin to set aside those things that are extra to what our focus needs to be. And we hone in on those things that need to be central. When God, in Matthew 6, as I have used the scripture in previous sermons, talks about that we should be praying and fasting to Him in private, what He's saying, He says, the relationship between you and me personally must be above all relationships on the earth. It must be the most dear thing there is to your heart. And it isn't important to show it to everyone else in a public way so that you can have credit. What's important is that you have indeed the relationship. Meditation is the removal of our mind to privacy. It is not a blank mind. It is not transcendental meditation where you focus on a sound or a note or some symbol in some way and lose yourself into that. No, it's focused mind. It's focusing your mind in a private arena. It's effectively time for your mind to be alone. Because we live in a society that is designed where we will never be alone. Where we will never have someone that isn't telling us what to think or what to do or how to act in a way that will fill our mind. We have to be selective. We have to take times and find extended ways in which to have our mind alone. Two times in my life, I have spent extended time alone. They have both turned out to be fundamental times in my life when I was turning a core, changing course, when I was having to enter a whole new perspective and I had to sort those things out. In both cases, it turned out to be a very great blessing. The first time was when I was living on a ranch in New Mexico as I began for that first time to attend services in the Worldwide Church of God. And I lived out on a ranch. The ranch was 70 miles from the nearest store, I think I mentioned. Ranchers know that it's only 15 miles to the nearest bar because they wanted beer more than they wanted milk. So the bar was out in ranch country and the store was off in town. But it was a long ways. Out there by myself at first, I had a lot of time alone. I was on the ranch for 15 months, working at a smelter during the daytime. On the weekends, I would come back and I stayed on the ranch, and sometimes I'd saddle a horse and just wander up into the mountains behind the ranch. Big Hatchet Mountain was out there, and there was about a 2,000 foot cliff face and old caves on it and Indian artifacts laying around. And sometimes on Saturday night, I'd come back to the ranch and throw a bedroll on the back of the horse and jump on the horse, and I would just ride up into the mountains and find a place to tie the horse off or some grass or old corral, and I'd spend the day hiking all by myself and come back in that evening on the horse. And just had a lot of time to think. I would go out in the evenings by myself and chase down the jackrabbits as I jogged, as they'd skitter off through the cactus. And right behind the ranch was a little hill that acted kind of like a natural amphitheater. And I'd crawl to the top of that hill and I'd sit down and I could hear the conversations down on the ranch below. Conversations that were maybe quarter to half a mile away, and they would just rise right up this natural slope, and I could hear right at the top normal it was an incredible thing. But I'd sit out there by myself and I'd run and I'd ride the horses and had a remarkable time. And there were times then that I was a little lonely because it was out there so much by myself, although I did have friends and had associations as well, but still a lot of time was spent alone. What that did, though, that was when God was calling me to baptism. That's when God was calling me into the church. That's when God was trying to show me what I needed to leave behind, and my thoughts and my ways and my habits and my values. I had to change them all. I remember what I was like. I wasn't, you know, socially I was pleasant, but I've made so many mistakes, and I made so many of them back then that had horrible consequences and things that I did. I had to stop using drugs when I was coming into the church. I had to stop doing everything else. God didn't call me out of a real nice, casual, wonderful environment. He called me out of a mess I'd made. And so that was a time out there in the ranch when I sorted those things and began to process and really began to search God out. It's crazy to think now I'm gonna say, but I remember one of the reasons that really decided, right before I was baptized, I decided I'd better go ahead and get baptized because I didn't think it was a good idea to keep getting drunk. Now, you say, well, that's a crazy reason to get baptized. Well, no, I knew what was in process, but I decided that this has got to go, this has got to stop, and I was so embarrassed that I had allowed this to happen again, because that's the way I had been, that's the way I'd grown up, well, that's the way I was, that I just said, no, I got to stop, I got to make a break, I got to go forward, and I did. I contacted the minister, I said, look, I got to be baptized, I got to start, I got to go somewhere here. And I did, and I began to counsel for baptism, and very shortly after that I was. Now, maybe that's, I'd like to say, well, yeah, what motivated me was because I finally had obtained righteousness, and I was so proud of myself that I knew it was time to be dunked. You know, it was kind of a desperate act on my part to try to clean up and go on with my life. But I look back, I had time alone to process those things, and it was a blessing, and process them I did. And that was when I decided back then that I wanted to go to Ambassador College, that the college that I had in Oregon was fine, but in my personal goal at that point, that's where I wanted to be. And so my life changed as a result of having time, in that sense, to be alone. What did God do with Israel when he wanted them to serve him as a nation? Where did he take them? To the nearest metropolitan area? Did he take them out to some place where they could have all of the amenities of the culture of the day? No, he took them, as was portrayed, out of sin, out of Egypt, and he took them out into the wilderness. I mean, he took the whole nation to serve him, to be a spouse to him, and took them out into the wilderness to be alone with God. When Moses went to Pharaoh and said, you know, we want to go out into 3 days' journey into the wilderness to sacrifice unto our God, to effectively to be alone with our God, to get away from you, to get away from your society and your values. We want to go out there and be alone with our God. And that's what God wanted as well. Joshua chapter 1, verse number 8. All that time out there in the wilderness, Israel should have learned something, should have learned what their focus needed to have been. Joshua 1, verse number 8. They should have learned that this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. They should have learned that they ought to be focusing, since they now had time to do so, on their relationship to God and God's law, and they ought to be thinking about it all day and all night. It ought to be a part of everything they process, that you may observe to do according to that which is written in it, for then you will make your way prosperous, then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? It says, be strong and be of good courage. Don't be afraid or dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go, and you ought to be thinking about that. You ought to be focused on that. You ought to be reminding yourself about that. That's what Israel should have learned out there by themselves in the wilderness and all that time. Unfortunately, they really didn't learn that. Second time in my life I was alone for some extended periods of time was after I graduated from Ambassador College, and I had to then begin and start on a career. There were no hirings into the ministry at that time, so that was out. I had really wanted to live my life doing adventure sports. I had my scuba gear, and I was certified, and I was skiing, and I had my gear, and I had my rock climbing gear, and had taken lessons, and we'd sailed on the ocean, and we had hiked, and that was my passion, and that's what I was going to do my with my life. And I had a chance after I graduated from college, go up to SEP and then come back down. And I worked on Camp River Glen, which was a Girl Scout camp the church leased that year. And we had gone up at the beginning of summer and helped to open it up and repair the bridge and get it to where the church could begin to use it for the teens in the area and also church family groups. And then I went back up in the fall for Mike Blackwell to close it down. A wonderful, wonderful time in my life. I would go up there Sunday night. There had been a group in for the weekend. And then I would be alone, absolutely alone, until about Friday. Sunday night to Friday, I would never see another human being. I was the only person in the camp. The camp was a national forest and up in the mountains and all alone. And I'd go around and I'd fix up things and repair things. And I found it's an amazing thing, but even when nobody's around, your mind continues to speak and talk. Now, I didn't use my lips anymore because that would have looked silly. I would have made the bears nervous if they'd have seen me walking around speaking to myself. But when there's nobody to talk to, you keep talking, but you end up talking to God. You do. Your mind keeps on going. Pretty soon, I'd be just saying, well, God, let's go get some lunch, you know. And I'd say, I think I'll do it. You know, I found my mind after a few days alone like that, you still seek to communicate. You still desire to communicate. So you begin to focus your thoughts to God. And so I did that for about a month's time or more. I forget exactly how long it lasted. But it was a delightful time in my life. And I did the same thing. I was at a turning point in my life. My college education was finished. My future responsibilities still lay ahead. And I had opportunity again to sort those things and to think and process what was important, what I needed to do, what I ought to do, and to put values on those things and then go back to proceed. And it was a great blessing in my life, a time when I honestly just could not avoid talking to God. 1 Kings 17. Notice this account. How God worked with Elijah. 1 Kings 17, verse number 1. Says Elijah here said to Ahab, as the Lord God of Israel lives before whom I stand, there shall be not dew nor rain these years except at my word. So Elijah had to go and confront Ahab here, the king. And the word of the Lord came to him and said, get away from here and turn eastward and hide out by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. He says, drink from the brook and I'll have ravens feed you while you're there. And so the indication is here that he was all by himself. And why would God do that? I used to wonder, why would God just send him out there? Is he hiding? Well, couldn't he just take him someplace in some nice little place that nobody knew about? He could hide him there, but no, he took him out there alone. And it wasn't like he had a support system of people going back to the supermarkets because even the birds were feeding him, so nobody really knew where he was. And he was out there for some part of 3.5 years. Considerable amount of time, it would appear, to be alone. What he did out there, alone with God and reflecting on his purposes and his life, probably prepared him for the test to come. After this period of time, he went on to live with a widow and her family, and they were broke, and he had to be able to trust God for every single meal. He went on, and the son's health was very poor, apparently, as well, and the son died and had to actually be brought back to life, and Elijah was used in the course of that as well. Then he had to go back and face Ahab again, who by now was hopping mad at what had happened to his country. Then he had to face and put to death 850 of the false prophets of Baal, which was no small task. Then he had to have the faith to pray for rain and then go stand up to Jezebel. You can get a guy mad, but don't you ever get his wife mad. Yeah, it's a whole different issue. And that kind of blew Elijah's fuse. And this big portion of this 3.5 years that he was out there, whatever it was seemed to be enough to prepare him for all these difficult tasks. 1 Kings 19. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, how he'd executed the prophets with the sword. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah and said, so let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. We have a saying in our society, in the vernacular, and effectively what you said is, you're dead meat. That's it. You're over. Your goose is cooked. You've ridden the last train. It's done. And that made Elijah rather nervous. And yet he had accomplished all these great tasks. And so God took him out on a refresher course. Where did he go? Well, took him into the nearest city and give him a break, put him up in the hotel, jacuzzi bath, a little wine, relax those tired muscles, let go of your worries. Not the way God did it. He says he went by himself in verse 4, after having run for his life, a day's journey into the wilderness, and came and sat down under a broom tree, prayed that he might die. He said, it's enough, I've had it, I can't take any more of this. Take my life. I'm no better than my fathers. They're all dead. And he lay and slept under the broom tree, and an angel touched him and said, arise and eat. So he did so, and the angel came back a second time, said, arise and eat. And he arose and ate and drank. And he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. And he went into a cave there, and God now speaks to him, begins to get his focus. But what did he do? He had this long period of time again to stop and assess his priorities. Think about what he had done. Think about what he needed to do, what he should be doing. And then God said, okay, now I'm going to talk to you again. I have some more work for you to do. Verse number 15. The Lord said, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria, anoint Jehu here as king over Israel, and Elisha as a prophet in your stead, in your place. And so he had to go out and fulfill those responsibilities as well. But it was kind of like after God gave him a refresher course, being alone to get his focus back so that he could take him on and do great things again. Time and time again, God has put those leaders of his people that had significant responsibilities in a position where they had no choice but to meditate and think about their lives, and where God then could get their attention. I know God got my attention in a stronger way with the way that my life then worked out, as maybe he would have in some other circumstance where I had filled my life with what I had chosen myself. I just know that when I was out there alone and lonely at times and searching for a relationship or companionship in some way, that I found myself searching more for God than I might have in some other environment. You know, maybe that's also part of why the agricultural society of our nation has been a more moral society, has been a more conservative society, because you do have time alone. You do think. You're not filled with all of the activities and all of the enticements of the city because you're out there on that land and you're working by yourself day in and day out in many cases. And maybe it does change your focus in the way you think. When can we meditate? We don't all have the option. I don't even have the option anymore of just being off by myself. We can meditate while we drive or at other times that are open in our lives. When I go running, I can tell within minutes if I'm at peace or not. I can just tell the minute I take off running. Now, in the house, there's calls or there's busy or there's objects that you have to be addressing or there's something that needs with the family or whatever, there's relaxation. But it's not the same. But the minute I take off and I run and I'm off there and all of a sudden I'm by myself. I'm all by myself and I'm not talking to anyone and I've just got my mind running and I can tell within just a couple of minutes whether I'm relaxed or not, because you can see then mentally what's racing through your mind. And I remember so many times out running with stress and frustration and anger, and I'd add another couple of miles. And yet I know those times too when I take off and I look out and I go, wow, what a beautiful day. Look at the flowers today, or look at the weather and the clouds today, and I watch the wind blow the tufts of clouds across the sky. I can tell when I'm preoccupied, and I can tell when I'm relaxed, when my mind is free. Interesting thing, it's when my mind is free that I stop and begin to think about God. And it's when my mind is stressed and full of frustration and duty and obligation or whatever stress in my mind that some of my communication with God is more angry or more frustrated or more pointed, and it's not quite as submissive and as gentle as it ought to be. And I find myself sometimes asking God, well, why this or why that or how come? And when my mind is free and relaxed, I can just be more thankful and grateful for what God has given me and more appreciative for what his purposes really are. We need to use meditation, brethren, to strengthen our relationship to God and to more fully focus and point our way in this life. We can meditate while we pray. We can ask God to help us to think through a problem. Psalm 4, a number of the Psalms refer to meditation. And so I'd like to at least refer to a few of the Psalms. But Psalm number 4, we have here a Psalm of David. David, he says, "Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me when I was in distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer." So he's in the context of prayer and he's crying out here and communicating with God. He says, "Be angry," in verse 4, "and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still." David is now saying, he says, you know, stop and think and process. And he says, and be quiet, be still, relax. He's saying we need to make contact with God and then we need to let go, relax. Release of some of those pressures and frustrations. And then verse 8, he starts out saying, "Hear me when I call," crying out to God. And he finishes with, "I will both lie down in peace and sleep. I'll actually go and be at rest now. For you alone, O Lord, make me to dwell in safety." After David had processed his relationship with God and really thought and meditated on it, it gave him peace because he was able to trust God more and rely more on God and his will and his purpose. David went on in Psalm 19 and said, "Let the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, O God." He said, "Let even what I think be something that is acceptable to you. The thoughts that go through my mind be something that are right." David, with all of his faults, also had some remarkable strengths, but he was concerned about even pleasing God with what was in his mind. When we study the Bible, it's easy to read through the Bible and just get a story flow, like reading a storybook, but we need to begin to picture what we read. We need to start to ask ourselves the kind of questions so that we understand the passage and what is missing that we don't understand. What is it that we haven't filled in? Try to put ourselves in the place of those things as well and how we would react. We need to meditate on that in the course of our Bible study. The comet that we have had hanging over the night sky in the evenings over the last few weeks, to look outside and see that comet, something that I have never in my life seen before, and just realize what an incredible thing that is, and begin to ponder again God's creation and His purposes. That's a ball of dirt or ice or whatever it is up there flying along, and there's just millions of miles of vision and view because of that. It's an incredible thing. I used to sit outside in Lubbock when we were there. We had a swing set for the kids in the backyard. And at night, everyone would go to bed, and then the last thing I'd do sometimes before I went to bed, because it was perpetually warm down there, and you could go out almost any time at night, and I'd sit on those swings, and I'd look up at the sky, and I'd sit there and ponder, and I'd just sit there a while. Be sometimes where I could, the last thing I would do before I went to bed. Pray a little bit to God and talk to Him and just meditate and think about what I had done that day and what was yet to come. It's amazing when you begin to focus on something. My wife had the movie on a little while back that Dr. Zhivago. I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. And she thought it was a love story, and that's what I remembered, love story. I was working some in the basement, and I'd walk up and I'd look at it, and then I'd walk down. The more I walked up, the more interested I got. Pretty soon, I'm sitting in the chair. I'm watching this thing, and I didn't even remember the movie. It had been so long. And I sat there and I watched it, and then I went up afterwards and I sat in the kitchen. I started thinking about it and I started to cry. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, what a lousy movie. Everything goes wrong. Everybody loses. Nobody stays right or pure. They all do the wrong things and they just destroyed. The evil prosper for a time, then they're destroyed. And I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe the misery. But, you know, you can sit there and watch something and it's kind of shocking, and sometimes you stop and reflect and think about it, and it begins to take a deeper focus in your own mind and in your prostate or heart. Excuse me. No. God would have us to stop and really meditate on our lives and to find ways to use that time, to find that time, and to use it to direct our course. Sometimes we can even meditate while we work. Don't get yourself killed. Don't drive off the road or anything. A church member years ago was custodian in a lumber mill, and he came to me, and it was a difficult circumstance for him because he wasn't making the money he needed for his family, but at the same time, it was the level of skill that he had, the only opportunity was available. He said, you know, I'm frustrated that I have a job that is so repetitive, and frankly, sometimes it's just downright boring. He says, there is one benefit. He says, what I do doesn't take a lot of concentration. It's just something that I do as I go. And he says, it gives me time to think. He says, the one benefit to what I do is it gives me time to meditate. And he would sit there and he would work on sermonettes and process things as he worked. And he says, that's the one redeeming factor of this that I have to do. You know, we can lie awake at night. I don't know, what do they say, count sheep? Don't count sheep. Meditate. Use some of that time. Psalm 63 talks about meditation in the sense that, again, David here, he says, O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. He just says, you know, I really, really want contact with you. And then he goes on and he says in verse 5, my soul shall be satisfied with marrow and fatness. My mouth shall praise you with joyful lips. He says, when I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. He describes times when either as he's laying there awake at night and sleep, or if he's even up at duty, on guard duty, or whatever the night watch he refers to. But the times when he's there awake, he says, I stop and I meditate on you, and I think about you, and I focus on my relationship with you because you've been my help. Therefore, in the shadow of your wings, I will rejoice. You know, life is a series of detours oftentimes that we need to learn to enjoy. It's not what you would have chosen. It's not what you would have laid out. It's not the ideal, but it is indeed where you are and where you're going. And we need to learn to enjoy the scenery while we're on a detour because we're there. And there's not going to be any way around that. You don't go back. Obviously, the Sabbath is an important time as well, and I believe God intended as we are able to use Sabbath time to meditate as well. What do we meditate on? God's plans, God's purposes, God's will. Psalm 143 describes what God is doing. Hear my prayer, O Lord, give ear to my supplication. In your faithfulness answer me, and in your righteousness do not enter into judgment with your servant, for in your sight no one living is righteous. The enemy has persecuted my soul. He has crushed my life to the ground. He has made me dwell in darkness, like those who have long been dead. Therefore my spirit is overwhelmed within me. My heart within me is distressed. He's talking about his troubles. He's focusing on his trauma, his frustration. And then in verse 5 he says, you know, when I think, though, about the days of old, he says, when I meditate on all your works, when I muse on the work of your hands, I spread out my hands to you, and my soul longs for you like a thirsty land. When I stop and I analyze what I am in and the troubles that I face, and then I begin to think of you and what you've done for me and how you've spared me, and when I spread out, then I want to spread out my hands back to you, and I long for you like a land. Like a thirsty land longs for rain or for nourishment. And David just said, you know, I stop and I focus on you and I want you back. I want that relationship back. I want your will back in my life. Psalm 8. O Lord, our God, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. Out of the mouth of babes and infants you have ordained strength. Because of your enemies, that you may silence the enemy and the avenger. When I consider your heavens, when I meditate on the creation, when I look at that comet and I begin to picture just indeed what that is a little tiny ball of dirt, 20, 30 miles across, or at the most, some small little speck in space. And yet what a magnificent part of creation that is. When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon, the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you visit him? That helps me understand why Elijah was able to go back then and trust God the way he did. Why Moses was able to change and develop meekness and humility in the process. It helps me to understand how Jesus went out for 40 days and 40 nights before facing that test with Satan. how John the Baptist grew up in the wilderness before he was there to declare the greatness of God to Israel in that day. For you've made him just a little lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor. You've made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under his feet. Sheep and oxen, beasts of the field, birds of the air, fish of the sea. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. That comes from meditation. From David, I believe, meditating on the work of God's hands, and he would write that down then as a result. You know, we need to meditate on our own life and our work, on our job, on our family, on our marriage, on our personal growth, where we are in this life and our service to God. We need to analyze the lessons we learned in the past, our goals and our plans for the future. We need to compare those to what we understand God's will to be. We need to meditate on God's law. We need to think about God's law continually in a way that we, again, analyze and compare it to us and what we need to understand. Psalm 119 talks about God's law. So much of the Psalms make reference to meditation. Psalm 119, verse 97. Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies, for they are ever with me. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for your testimonies are my meditation. We all like to talk to someone who's really thought a matter through and begin to express what they have learned to us. It's pleasant. It's exciting. It's wonderful. God gives us understanding, but we have to search it out, to meditate, to focus our minds. Paul gave Timothy advice on how to be a minister and a servant in his church. 1 Timothy 4. Is a passage, 1 Timothy 4, verse number 11, that he wanted Timothy to focus on in his ministry. He says, these things command and teach. And so he's given instruction here, and he's reminding Timothy to carry through and be faithful to them. He says, let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, and in purity. Until I come, give attention to the reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. He says, do not neglect the gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of hands of the presbytery. He says, meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all. Think about your service, your responsibility, the gift that is in you, the doctrines which you indeed understand. You give attention to reading and study. He says, go ahead and then meditate on these things. Give yourself entirely to them so that you can absorb them and put them together and so that they will be part of your life and they will be evident to all. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine and continue in them. For in doing this, you will save both yourself and those who hear you. Meditation and thought and properly directed thought is fundamental to this Christian life. And in our calling before God, it's a tool we use to tune up our minds and to maintain contact with God. Through meditation, we receive strength, we gain perspective, we receive wisdom and understanding, we develop vision, and we are able to focus on the necessary removal of sin from our lives and our part and responsibility in that. Meditation is a tool that we must take advantage of. Meditation. Think about it.